me, Lord, and make me mean.
I'm Woody Overton, host of Real Life, Real Crime, the podcast. Join me each week to hear true and unscripted stories of the cases I actually worked during my career as a major crime investigator in South Louisiana. Go to realliferealcrime.com where you can listen to each week's episodes and find links to our social media. I appreciate y'all. Don't let me catch you down on the bayou.
I'm Eve Lazarus, and I'm a reporter and an author based in Vancouver, British Columbia. I host and produce Blood, Sweat and Fear, the story of Inspector Vance. Vance wasn't a police officer, as his title suggests. He was the first forensic scientist to work for a police department in Canada, and certainly the first to carry a badge and a gun. Vance was so good that he was known as the Sherlock Holmes of Canada, and his forensic skills were so advanced that in 1934, there were 7 attempts on his life by criminals afraid to go up against him in court. Each episode follows a different major crime that Vance helped to solve. You can find Blood, Sweat and Fear on Apple, Podbean or your favourite podcatcher.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you are the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hi, Jan.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Are we getting ready to finish this?
This long story? Why, yes, we are.
Mm-hmm.
Today's episode 3. Hoping to wrap this up in 4. So woo-hoo. Wednesday, Thursday.
Yeah, this guy's a real scum.
Yes, he is. So you want to just dive right in?
Let's do it.
It's going to be kind of long. So when we last left you guys, last week we had just learned that Bo Bowenkamp, he owns the local market with his wife, had just been shot by Ken Rex McElroy, who has become the town bully.
Sexy Rexy.
The nice thing about him.
Right.
So here we go. You ready?
Yep, let's go.
The following morning after Bo was shot at point blank range, July 9th, 1980, Robert Nury, the prosecuting attorney for Nottoway County, filed a felony complaint against Ken McElroy, charging him with the Class A felony, assault in the first degree. Nury urged the magistrate to set a bond in the amount of $50,000. The magistrate instead approved a bond for $30,000.
Oh, good.
And with that, McElroy was released from custody and sent back into the community.
Of course he was.
Now, of course, there's some rules. Because, you know, he's a rule follower.
Oh, yeah.
McElroy had to agree to keep the peace and be on good behavior.
Oh, he can do that. That's easy.
However, he can still carry firearms.
Well, I'm not even going to make a comment.
Seriously? Like, come on.
Well, what year is this? 80?
1980.
Yeah.
But he just shot somebody or has been accused of that. And here, you go on and just do your thing.
Yeah, nobody cares.
On the very next evening after the shooting, the door of the D&G Tavern flew open and in came Ken McElroy with Trina. Now, Trina was his wife, if you remember.
I do remember.
The young wife. People in the tavern froze. They were shocked. McElroy walked up to the bar, ordered a beer, and settled on the very stool that he had sat on the previous night before he shot Bo. The silence was soon broken as McElroy asked out loud, but not really to anyone in particular, "What was all that commotion about last night? Was there a burglary in the grocery store?" And he chuckled.
'Cause He's a dipshit. That's why.
He's a sweetheart.
Sorry.
That's what he is.
Sorry for my language.
To his family and friends, McElroy played the innocent as if it was all self-defense, that big, mean man, Bo, came after him with a knife, and he was simply trying to defend himself right then and there. So when Bo was released from the hospital, his family wanted to make sure he was hidden out of sight. Bo went to stay with his daughter, Cheryl, and her family for a few days. Cheryl was really worried that McElroy would track him to her house, and she didn't want any part of that. So she asked the sheriff for protection and was told, as usual, sorry, we can't do anything.
Hmm?
Yeah. Tim Warren, who's a minister of the area Christian church, went to visit Lois and Bo and told her, you know, if you need anything, you just call me. I'll do anything I can to help. Now, Warren kept up his visits after Bo came home, but he also kept all his guns loaded and one gun in his truck, just in case. For the first month or two, the phone calls came every other day or so. Even on days he hadn't seen Bo, the voice called the minister fat boy, stupid, cocksucker, and other vulgar names. Just wait, it gets worse. Sometimes the threats were short, such as what I just detailed. Other times, very detailed and descriptive. If you keep on minding other people's business instead of your own, we're going to rape your wife in front of you, and then we're going to cut your little boy's sex organs off and make him eat them while you watch.
Aww.
Warren shot
that,
back.
You could almost put that in a Christmas card.
Right?
Yeah.
That's happy sweet holidays. Tired of it, Warren shot back. If you're so brave, you come here and do it. Not long after that, the trucks began coming by as if the challenge was accepted. Sometimes it would be only McElroy. Sometimes Tarina followed him in another truck. And other times, a third truck with another woman driving. They'd come in the day. They'd come in the night. It was nonstop. So when he was harassing Warren and Bo and everybody else, he was also busy harassing Corporal Stratton. Calls would start coming in to his wife, Margaret. And these calls would say things like, your husband's not going to live to testify. But the caller would also inform Margaret that they knew where her two daughters lived, described their houses in detail, listed the number and ages of children each of them had, where the children went to school, etc., etc.
Hmm.
He did his homework, obviously. Stratton's daughter, Pam, worked in Maryville as a checker at a local store. Not long after the shooting happened, McElroy began standing in her checkout line with a basket full of goodies. After she'd rung all of them up, he would turn and walk away, empty-handed. And you got to remember, this is back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Where everything, you didn't scan everything, it was put
so
in.
So she had to cancel each item one by one. Stratton's other daughter, Vicky, worked as a nurse at St. Francis Hospital in Maryville. On two or three occasions, she noticed Ken McElroy standing around in the halls on the floor where she worked. In the hospital! Can you believe that? So she'd go and check and see if there was any reason he'd be there, if he was visiting somebody, and then he'd just disappear. He would, like, go to the hospital and stalk. Like, how insane is that?
Well, he wanted to get what he needed.
He cray-cray.
He didn't want to go to prison, so this is what he was going to do. It was intimidation and fear. That's yep how he worked.
McElroy drove into town at least once a day, sometimes by himself, sometimes followed by other trucks. If McElroy stayed in the tavern for hours, the women in the backup trucks sat in position for those hours. You got to love this part. When he left, they would follow him out of town in a single file. McElroy had later explained to people in the bar that the women stayed out there so he could relax. It's weird.
Well, he's
weird.
Well, he's not exactly.
You can all follow me up here in your trucks, but you don't get to come in. And if I'm going to go in there with my friends, he didn't really have any.
Well, he did, but they were all afraid of him. They were scared of him.
They were frenemies.
Well, they felt the need to be friends with him because the other option was not a very good one.
With all that has happened, Marshall Dunbar, now you remember we met him. He was the one that was, you know, deputized, I guess, to be a marshal. He began to rethink this position as lawman. Dunbar was only making $240 a month. And to Dunbar, his life was not worth that money if he took on McElroy, which he would, and he would lose. Monday morning following the shooting, Dunbar walked over to the city hall and turned in his badge, resigning as Marshal of Skidmore. He couldn't deal with McElroy anymore. And you know what? No one blamed him. $240 bucks? Even back then, that wasn't very much. A month? in the 80s, that's not that much.
That was probably around $500. I mean, not...
A month, that's still nothing. Not a week, a month.
But for some people, that's a lot.
So the prelim hearing for Beau was drawing near. Would witnesses actually show up, or would McElroy get to them? Beau was getting up in years. Would this trial be too much for him? McElroy knew that without Beau, there would be no trial. It is his mantra, after all. No witnesses, no crime.
No time.
The preliminary hearing began on the afternoon of August 18th, 1980, at the Nottoway County Courthouse in Maryville. The purpose of the hearing was to determine whether a crime had been committed if there was enough reasonable grounds to believe that Ken McElroy committed it. So McFadden, if you remember, McFadden is his trusted lawyer that he has hired and has so far not let him down. McFadden was there to represent McElroy with Robert Nury as prosecuting attorney. Presiding was Judge John Fraze. Now, that's the prosecutor that we talked about earlier, who just 5 years ago had been ready to prosecute Ken McElroy for rape, child molestation, assault, and arson. Now, the alleged victim of those crimes sat right there in his first row as the now wife of Ken McElroy, also mother of his three children. Three of some of them. On the other side of the aisle sat Lois, Beau, Evelyn, Cheryl, and Cheryl's sister. They were all nervous and scared, but they were there. They showed up. A state trooper had spent the previous night parked in the Bowen camp's driveway, making sure nothing would occur. That's terrible.
That is very terrible.
It was a little bitty small town, you know?
Well, he was able to do it because he
got away with it.
It was a small town. If it was a larger town, he couldn't have done it.
The hearing would give McElroy's lawyers a good idea of what the prosecution had, and currently the only two witnesses were Beau and Sheriff Estes. Beau, as an eyewitness, normally meant that there would be reasonable grounds for believing that the defendant had committed the crime. So with Beau present in the courtroom, it should be a no-brainer, right? I mean, he's there.
Right.
He didn't die, so it's like, yeah, he did it. No, of course not, because with McElroy, you never know. When called to testify, Beau was difficult to understand on the stand due to his injuries, but he told a story of what happened on that store dock. McElroy did not need to testify since it was his right to do so. McFadden moved to dismiss the charge against his client. Of course he did. But the judge denied the motion and found that there was reasonable doubt to believe that McElroy had committed the crime of felony assault in the first degree. The judge ordered McElroy bound over for trial, continued the bond, and set the next court date for September 5th. Nury, citing the strong possibility of intimidation, you think? asked the judge to order McElroy not to have any contact with either of the Bowen camps. The judge granted the request. When Trina and McElroy left the courtroom, the Bowen camps remained seated, with six troopers standing in front of them, as if there were a wall to protect them.
Wow.
Since it's one guy.
Well,
how about the money wasted, too, the trials and stuff? McElroy's attorney, McFadden, knew if he stood a chance, he needed to get the case transferred out of Nottoway County. McFadden filed his motion for a change of venue on September 2nd. The judge granted the request and transferred the case to Bethany, the Harrison County seat, some 80 miles east of the community where the crime had occurred. The case of the state of Missouri versus Ken Rex McElroy was assigned to Judge John Morgan Donaldson, Circuit Judge of Harrison County. His first judicial act in the case was to schedule the trial for December 5th, 1980. So with nothing else to do but wait for trial, the calls begin again. Tim Warren was outside playing. Now, Tim Warren was the minister,
right,
if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
He was outside playing ball.
He was the, wasn't he the one that they called him names?
Oh, yeah.
He was basically Rudolph.
Yeah. Tim Warren was outside playing ball with his son when the phone rang. "I'm tired of warning you and telling you," said the oh-so-familiar male voice. "I'm going to come over and castrate you, and then I'm going to cut up your little boy in pieces and feed him to you while you're laying there bleeding from the castration. We're going to send you pieces of your wife's body in an envelope, and you're going to know that we're killing her bit by bit. It's too late now, you fat son of a bitch. You pushed me too far." With a deep breath, Warren responded. He had really had it. You're so brave on the phone, and I'm tired of your threats. If you're so brave, I'm going to set my little boy and my wife on the porch right now, and you come over, and you just try to get them. You want to use knives? We'll use knives. You want to use guns? We'll use guns. But I'll tell you what, you're not going to walk away alive if you show up.
No.
Do you think McElroy showed up?
No.
No, he did not.
Why would he?
And the call stopped for a little while. McFadden got busy taking depositions for the Bowen Camp case. He started with the teens that were outside that tavern that infamous day. The first boy changed his story. Under oath, he said he had been fetching a bicycle tire from behind the pool hall, and actually he hadn't been there when McElroy approached the other boys. That's boy number one.
Mm-hmm.
The second boy said McElroy gave them money, but it was inside the tavern. And if you remember correctly, they were outside and he gave them money to go in and get soda to get rid of them because he didn't want them to see the crime.
Right.
So now this second boy goes back and says, no, he did give us money, but it was inside the tavern. The third boy had previously given police a written statement saying that he was present when McElroy gave the money to go inside and get soda. But at his deposition, the boy claimed that he had left the group before McElroy came over to talk to them. He hadn't heard or seen a thing. Fourth boy, yeah, McFadden claimed that they were unable to locate him. He's a teenager in Skidmore, Missouri. Are you kidding me?
There's nothing to do. Sure, he's out in the field getting drunk somewhere.
As McElroy's February 5th, 1981 trial date approached, his case did not look good. Bo was still alive and well. On January 22nd, 1981, 2 weeks before the trial was supposed to start, I learned a little something here.
Mm-hmm.
A senator named Richard Webster filed papers stating that he had been retained by McElroy and McFadden to represent McElroy in the case. But there's a little thing here. So if you notice, I said he was a senator, right?
Mm-hmm.
Webster also sought a continuance because you know what? The Missouri General Assembly would be in session until February 4th, and he had to be in attendance there. So therefore, the trial needed to be postponed. The lawyer legislator only had to file an affidavit stating that the fact that he was a senator and that the assembly would be in session in order to get the trial postponed.
Right.
The trial would not be able to start until 10 days after the assembly adjourned. McFadden had played the game beautifully, of course, if you can't tell by now. First, he got the case continued from December 5th, 1980, due to the assembly being in session. McFadden, you see, never planned to use this guy. He was using him only to get a delay. So he was smart enough to go hire this guy who would, in fact, be able to get the trial postponed. See mm-hmm. what he did there? Judge Donaldson understood what was happening, and he was not happy about it, but he couldn't do anything. He did, however, demand that if Webster didn't participate in this trial, he would be held in contempt of court. With no other choice, Donaldson continued the case to June 25th, 1981. Isn't that sneaky? So he goes and hires this guy because he knows that will be months that he gets to, you know?
Right.
With all this going on, McElroy is still gallivanting around town, being, you know, the cool guy that he is. And in doing so, he runs into the former mayor of Skidmore, and this guy's name is Larry Rolette. And they run into each other in the tavern one night. McElroy walked up to him, and he asked, hey, you know where I can get any copperhead snakes? I'll pay $50 apiece for some copperheads. If you know where there are any, you know, I'll gladly pay.
Well, hey, psst, they're in the woods. Psst, they're under logs.
Right?
And leaves.
So Rolette asked, puzzled, what in the heck do you want them for?
Yeah.
McElroy, as you know, is not shy about anything and says what he thinks and whatever. I'm going to put them in that old man's car and let them crawl around inside and then bite them.
Aww.
Another night, McElroy, he's a sweetheart. Another night, McElroy walked into the tavern with a wad of money and said he would give it to anyone who would go and kill Bo and make it look like an accident.
What?
Yeah. I mean, and he just walks around and does this and that. Yeah,
and nobody says a thing. Because they're afraid of him.
Nothing happened. McElroy at this point was now 47 years old and he was not in good shape health-wise. He was on a lot of medication, some for high blood pressure. and he was drinking a ton. McElroy, which had always been his passion slash somewhat of his job, had a lot of dogs, most of them hunting dogs, but he did have two German shepherds and two Dobermans. So the dogs were usually tied up, but one day one of his friends, and I use that term loosely, stopped by and the two dogs were running loose and they're growling and snarling and chasing him. He got so freaked out because the dogs were so vicious, he climbed on the roof of his car and he started yelling for McElroy to come and save him. McElroy laughed and he came out and he said, "You'd be surprised what happens to a dog when you keep him chained up, give him speed, and don't feed him for 4 days in a row."
No, I'm not surprised at all. And you know what's so sad? Our Dobermans and German Shepherds are such sweet dogs normally, but they're hungry and they're doped up. Yeah, that's abuse.
Now becoming clear that McElroy's body was not the only thing deteriorating. So was his mental state.
I mean, really?
It had been bad. It's getting worse.
I think his mental state was probably bad from the get-go.
It's getting worse,
I think,
though.
He was born broken.
In April 1981, Robert Nury resigned as prosecuting attorney for Nottoway County to return to the Marine Corps. People in town said that he must have left because he couldn't take the heat that came with prosecuting Ken McElroy, which may or may not be the case. He said it wasn't. Here enters a 28-year-old named David Bard, 3 years out of law school. He was well-spoken, thoughtful, and very sure of himself. Bard had attended grade school and high school in Maryville, which was nearby, and had graduated from Notre Dame in 1975. He obtained a degree from the University of Missouri at Columbia, Go Tigers, School of Law in 1978. In April, when Nury spoke to Bard about accepting the appointment as prosecuting attorney, the two of them reviewed the existing caseload. When they came to the McElroy case, set for trial in only 2 months, Nury suggested that maybe Bard, since he was new, might want to ask the state attorneys general to take over the case. Bard didn't consider the possibility for a moment. If anything, he anticipated the challenge and welcomed the opportunity to try a major felony case right out of the gate. Boy, was he naive. Bard knew all about McElroy, as he had worked previously with Amy Davis and assisted in the prosecution of Romaine Henry. Now, if you remember, that's the farmer that he shot in the stomach, barely lived, and McElroy was acquitted. As lawyers are prepping for the trial, McElroy is once again working too. McElroy is attending dog gathering conferences with a list of names on paper, a list of jurors in the trial. How did he even get that?
I have no idea.
His attorney, that's how. He wanted to know who these jurors were and how he could find them. McElroy showed his friend Ray Ellis the list, and Ray said, "Hey, yeah, I do know one of them, Daryl Ratcliffe." McElroy then asked Ray if he could contact him and, oh, I don't know, throw the jury for some money. And Ellis said, "Sure, I'll do that for you." So he was planning to buy off the jury and was going to pay them. And McElroy was under the impression that his friend was going to help him make this possible. With the trial approaching, prosecutor David Bard made two strategic decisions. One, he decided not to introduce the candy incident into the trial. Now, that's the thing that set all of this off, if you remember. His kids went in there and were told to pay for candy and marched out, and then he marched in, and then he had an axe to grind with Bo. The reason that Bard chose not to do this was because it would have shown a motive for McElroy's attack. Bard wanted the jury to see Bo, the elderly man, as a victim of an unprovoked attack. The second thing that Bard did was he amended the complaint to delete the language that McElroy had, quote, attempted to kill, end quote, Bo. The complaint now read only that McElroy had knowingly caused serious physical injury to Ernest Bonecamp by means of a deadly weapon. The charge remained first-degree assault, but this amendment allowed the jury to convict McElroy without finding that, at the moment he pulled the trigger, he intended to kill Bo. Both of these moves were decisions aimed primarily at obtaining a conviction. He was trying to make it easier to finally get McElroy convicted of something.
Right.
2 days before the trial, Bard brought Bo into the courthouse for a run-through. Bard was really tough on him and wanted to see how he would behave under the pressure. And thankfully, Bo did great and never strayed from his story.
Under pressure.
Finally, June 25th arrived and the trial was going to begin. Finally. The Bowen camps were learning more than anyone would ever care to learn about the American justice system. After arriving to the courtroom, prepared to watch, since, you know, it's in regards to them, they were informed that the victim, which was Bowen in this case, was not entitled to observe the trial of the alleged offender. The defendant could ask the court to exclude all witnesses from watching all the others' testimonies, which McElroy did, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Barred from the courtroom, Lois, Beau, and Evelyn spent most of the day sitting in a side room wondering what the heck was going on during the trial.
Sounds like a fun day.
The attorneys for both sides felt their cases were solid, and McElroy thought he had, you know, a good shot at hanging the jury since he believed he had paid off one of the jurors, courtesy of his friend Ray Ellis. A plea bargain was never discussed. No one on the jury panel had even heard of McElroy. Many of them were farmers from nearby. The issue at hand was whether or not McElroy had assaulted Beau or had shot him in self-defense. No one disputed that McElroy had been 2 feet from the edge of the dock when he fired, because the defense could place a knife in Beau's hand at the time. Remember, he was chopping, cutting boxes down. The critical fact was Beau's location. If he had been anywhere close to McElroy, the defense stood a chance of creating a reasonable doubt that McElroy had been in fear of his life. Beau claimed that he had been inside the store, and McElroy claimed that Beau had been on the edge of the dock, hovering over him with a knife. Through the testimony of investigating officers, the use of diagrams, and the introduction of other physical evidence, Bard laid the foundation for the case. The diagrams indicated that the dock was 6.5 feet long, a pool of blood on the floor was 39 inches from the doorway, the damage to the ceiling tile was another 13 feet in from the door. By drawing a line from the holes in the ceiling to McElroy's position, Barr demonstrated that Beau could have been shot in the neck only if he had been standing inside, about 3 feet from the doorway. If Beau had been outside on the dock, the pellets would have hit the outside of the door frame, not the ceiling on the inside of the building, 17 feet in.
Huh. Okay.
After establishing Beau's location, Bard tried to prove McElroy's intent. The man at the gas station testified that McElroy had threatened to teach the old man a lesson only a few hours before actually shooting him. Beau took the stand and told his story straightforwardly and without hesitation. Not wanting to risk appearing insensitive to the elderly man, McFadden went easy on him, asking him such questions as, "Isn't it possible you fell backward after you were shot?" Meaning, well, backward inside the building.
That's true.
Beau flatly denied the possibility. Corporal Stratton had been around most of the morning, either in the hallways or in the patrol office. Called to the stand to testify about the arrest, Stratton looked over at Ken McElroy, who was glaring at him with cold, penetrating eyes. Stratton stared back and was determined not to break away that stare. If necessary, he would not answer questions until the stare was broken. Finally, just as Bard was ready to begin the questioning, after what seemed to Stratton like the longest 5 minutes of his life, McElroy finally looked away. At the end of the prosecution's case, McFadden made a motion to dismiss the charges. Of course he did. But Judge Donaldson denied the motion. McFadden then called McElroy to the stand. Calling a defendant to the stand was always risky, but in the case of McFadden, he had no choice. His whole case rested on self-defense, and McElroy had to take the stand and explain why he was scared enough to shoot the old man in the face. With his hands in his lap, McElroy calmly explained that he had parked his truck and walked over and given the boys money so that they could go in the tavern and get a soda, and set up a pool game. When he returned to his truck, he testified it wouldn't start. He figured the vehicle had a vapor lock. While he was standing there waiting for the engine to cool down, Beau began yelling at him to get off his property. McElroy was about to get in his truck and try the engine again when he felt something behind him. Turning, he looked over his shoulder and saw Beau on the dock coming at him with a knife as if to stab him. Fearing for his life, McElroy reached in his truck and grabbed a shotgun from the dash. He turned the gun around in the truck and fired from the hip, intending only to scare the old man. He aimed over his head, after all. Bowen Camp disappeared from sight, but McElroy didn't realize he'd hit him. He thought he'd just scared Beau, and he went back in the store. McElroy drove home, picked up his wife, and was on his way to St. Joe when Stratton arrested him. Bard knew that McElroy wouldn't recant any of his testimony on cross-examination, so he didn't attack head-on. He handed McElroy the diagrams, and he had him describe for the jury where everything was placed, such as the location of the dock, where his truck was parked, where the boys were standing, and so on. In the first couple of questions, Bard referred to words already on the diagram, such as store or tavern, and McElroy seemed confused and was unable to locate them. Bard realized, it dawned on him, McElroy might not be able to read or write. In order to avoid the jury developing any sympathy for him, Bard began asking the questions without referring to the printed words. McElroy placed Beau right on the edge of the dock. Bard showed McElroy the curved knife and asked him what Beau was doing with it. McElroy said that Beau was holding it up in the air and stabbing down with it. Or cutting boxes, but he left that part out.
Yeah.
The only other witness for the defense was Selena O'Connor, who testified that she had seen Beau coming at McElroy with the knife. Terrified, she had climbed into her truck and driven away. Bard spent a great deal of time cross-examining her, aware that if a jury believed her, McElroy would probably be acquitted. She had admitted hearing about his arrest on the radio, so she knew he was in trouble. She was scared, she testified, and didn't want to get in trouble. She just kept hoping that the problem would work itself out.
Exactly.
The presentation of the evidence was completed by 5 p.m., and the judge sent the jury home. That evening, the lawyers and Judge Donaldson met in conference and hammered out the jury instructions, over which there was no serious disagreement for once, thank you. One instruction permitted the jury to find McElroy guilty of the lesser included offense of second-degree assault. While preparing for the trial and during the trial itself, Bard had had a feeling that one way or another, he was going to lose.
I'm gonna find you. I'm gonna get you, get you, get you, get you.
Knowing that no prosecutor had yet obtained a conviction against McElroy, he waited for the devastating cross-examination of his witness, or the surprise testimony that would knock a hole in the case. The blow never came, and when he went home Thursday evening, he thought for the first time, you know what? We might actually win the case. Now that the evidence had been completed, Beau and Lois were allowed into the courtroom to hear the closing arguments. Bard's closing argument was factual. The undisputed physical evidence, he argued, completely contradicted McElroy's version of events. The defense had tried a variety of approaches. Senator Webster, whose retention had delayed the trial for 4.5 months, addressed the jury in a good old boy fashion and talked about how good it was to be back in this part of Missouri.
Back in the saddle.
McFadden stood and made an emotional appeal to the jury. His poor client didn't deserve to go to prison for the simple act of defending himself. When the jury went out to deliberate, Tim Warren was close enough to hear and observe McElroy and his posse of women, the way. Tim Warren saw McFadden walk over to McElroy and start talking to him. And then McElroy exploded. I don't give a damn. I'm not going to spend one night in jail. I don't care what it costs or what it takes. I'm not going to jail. McElroy was right to be worried. Things were not going his way in the jury room. His friend Ray Ellis had not kept his promise. He never contacted Daryl Ratliff and asked him to throw the jury. In fact, Daryl Ratliff was arguing strongly to the other jurors that Beau was telling the truth and McElroy was, in fact, lying. After much debating, the jury foreman gave the verdict to the clerk. This is very important here, Jen.
Mm-hmm.
The clerk stood up and announced that the defendant was guilty.
Wow.
I know. McElroy showed no reaction. The judge excused the jury and announced that the defendant would have 30 days to file a motion for a new trial, seeing the shooting as a singular, isolated incident, like a confrontation between two drivers. The jury felt that 2 years was enough. Now, here's the catch. Much of the derogatory information about McElroy was not allowed before the jury, so they had no idea of his past, no idea how many times he's been in trouble. Two deputies, after they were dismissed, raced to catch up with a few of them because they wanted them to know. He told the jurors who McElroy was and then gave him a long list of all the things that he had been accused of doing or had done and never been in trouble. The jurors felt deceived, used, and honestly, they were just mad. They were upset that they didn't get that information, and they feel now, looking back, had they known that, they would have at least given him 5 years. So as it stands right now, McElroy walked the streets, basically a free man. He was given 2 years, but he got to be out until they filed for a new trial. On Friday afternoon after the trial, Gary Walker ran into Ken McElroy alone in the tavern. Gary asked him what happened. "The jury convicted me," he said, "and they gave me 2 years. But I'll tell you what, I'm never going to jail. I'll appeal it, and I'll get off." McElroy seemed to almost be bragging about the conviction. He also added, "I've been fighting prosecutors since I was 13 years old, and I'm almost 50. I've been arrested for over 53 felonies, and this is the first one I ever lost. I'll tell you what, my fucking lawyer better get me off. I've already paid him $30,000, and now he wants another $20,000 for the appeal." The community knew that McElroy would not take this new development very well. In fact, many people in Skidmore felt that it would have been better to acquit him than to convict him, because him going to jail, it was just going to send him into a frenzy into town.
Gotcha.
McElroy was feeling the pressure, and one day, Ken and Trina asked Alice Wood if she would actually be the custodian of their children if both of them died. He was starting to sense something was up, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Alice agreed.
Well, you can only get away with something for so long before your luck runs out.
Alice agreed, and the papers were drawn up and executed, and they were put in the lawyer McFadden's safe. On June 30th, 1981, 4 days after his conviction, Ken McElroy drove into town in the Silverado, and Trina followed behind him in the green Chevy along with the gun, since McElroy could not carry a gun now. The couple entered the D&G Tavern, where Red Smith was behind the bar, Pete Ward and his two sons, Wesley and Wilson, Gary Dowling, a local farmer, and Larry Rolette were all on bar stools. McElroy sat and ordered a beer from Red. After a few minutes, McElroy got up and walked over to where Pete Ward was, and he asked him if he was a war vet. Now, Pete, he was a tough old guy, did not like this fella at all. After Pete said yes, McElroy said, "Hey, I have a gun. I want you to look at for me." He told Trina to go to the truck and retrieve the gun, because Trina could have the gun, of course. He couldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in the car with both of them, but whatever. Trina handed the gun to McElroy, and he began showing it off, asking everyone what they thought of it, waving it around, talking about what a neat gun it was.
Too bad it didn't go off in his face.
Then he reached inside his pocket and brought out a 5-round clip. He slapped the clip into the rifle, jacked a shell into the chamber, and began talking about what he was going to do to Bo, all the while popping the clip in and out and jabbing it through the air. Larry Rolette figured he'd seen enough. He sucked down his beer and he left. The Wards and Gary Dowling stayed behind. Pete Ward stood up and said, "Like hell you will." And he stomped out of the tavern. His sons followed behind him. So that same day, after this all occurred, Pete turned to the law for help. Knowing that McElroy had violated his bond by carrying a firearm, and, you know, assuming that threatening to kill a person was, in fact, a crime, Pete called the sheriff, told him the story, and asked him, "What are you going to do about it?" Estes said he was going to talk to Bard, who was the prosecuting attorney. Bard told Estes to get affidavits from the witnesses that were in the bar that witnessed all this, about what they had seen, what they had heard. When he brings in the affidavits, Bard would file a petition with the court to revoke McElroy's bond. On July 2nd, 1981, only 2 days after the incident in the tavern, Bard filed a motion seeking to revoke McElroy's bond, or, in the alternative, to add certain bond conditions, meaning stay at home and you can't leave your house.
Right.
If the court wouldn't put him in jail, then Bard asked that the court prohibit him from traveling around, crossing into, or being in the corporate city limits of Skidmore. Bard also requested that McElroy be prohibited from frequenting bars and taverns and from having any contact with any witness in the criminal case. Possessing a gun in public place was against the law in any part of Missouri. And as McElroy well knew, displaying a gun in a rude and angry manner in the presence of one or more persons was a felony. Tampering with or threatening a witness was also illegal. And if the threat was done for the purpose of trying to get a witness to not testify or testify falsely, that act too was a felony. Sheriff Estes could have, when he first learned of the incident, arrested McElroy right away for violating these laws as well as the conditions of his bond. David Bard could have also directed the sheriff to arrest him and detain him until he could obtain a hearing on the motion to revoke the bond. Under Missouri Supreme Court rules, Judge Donaldson had the specific authority to order that McElroy be arrested and held until a hearing on the bond petition could take place. Guess what? None of these things happened.
Really?
All the men knew that Pete, his two sons, and Gary Dowling had signed the affidavits, and that, in effect, the four of them were now walking around town with bullets on their back. If McElroy would learn their names, they would be gone. And we're going to stop right there and continue with part four of this long tragedy. Yeah.
He's something else. Wow, that's a long one. Very long. It's very interesting. I can't believe he's gotten away so much. I can't. I know what happens.
It's a little too detailed, but you know, hey.
I'm sure there's a lot that you cut out also.
I cut out so much. I cut out an entire trial that happened in the middle of the big trial.
Wow.
And if you read the book, it's good, but it's just kind of like, again, he got off. He got acquitted again in the middle of that, which only fed his ego to get off on this one.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, if you have any questions, you can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com, or you can send us a little note on Twitter @ourtruecrimepod. Anyway, we will see you tomorrow. So until then,
lock your doors
and keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya. I know, you need readers.
I do need readers. Hold on. I can make him bigger. There we go.
That's what she said.
Mm-hmm. Now, McFadden, as you remember, is his...
Bobby McFadden? Don't worry.
Oh, yeah, Bobby McFadden. Is that
McFadden? Be happy.
McFadden.
Don't worry, be happy.
So McFadden, if you remember from earlier, is
don't
his...
Don't worry, don't testify.
It's too late now, you fat son of a bitch. You pushed me too far.
Aww.
I like saying bad words when they're not mine. Like, it makes it exciting.
It's like being young and
I know, right?
Singing to the radio. Oops.
I got you. McFadden never... I had to shut up. I'm gonna punch you. I can't wait till you laughing. Do a show. Okay, ready? Then he worked as a legal aide in St. Joe. In April, when Nuri...
Saint. You need to start saying saint correctly.
I can't say a saint. How do I say it?
Saint.
That's how my accent. I can't help that. I can't help
you shouldn't
that.
Have an accent. I don't have an accent.
I don't know what you want me to say. Obviously, I have one.
Set and set, Fleur.
ST period, Joe. I'm just going to do that then.
Okay.
I'm not doing that.
Saint.
Hey, okay. You know, those people across the pond have an accent. You don't make fun of them. Okay, hold on.
You all right there?
I'm burping. Sorry, Nico. I'm drinking some iced tea. Bard. On the dock.
Of the bay?
Of the bay. Bo on the dock.
Okay, here we go.